Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of July 2021. Welcome to episode 74 of this podcast series, aka Work From Home Journal number 17, although this time of year it's more like normal old summer from home journal, so maybe slowly back to normal? Fingers crossed. Well, the concept of this show is to have just a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this pretty much, more or less, all the comic books I read during July. Those books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those. But those posts are not exactly spoilers for the podcast, since those are just lists. And here, there's a little more review, a little more critique, and a little bit more discussion. But first, a little feedback. On the June episode, we heard from faithful feedbacker Dr. Ange from the excellent blog Comic Box Commentary. Sounds like a great month of books. A few comments. Clockwork Girl sounds interesting. When you described it, I thought it sounded like a riff on Gift of the Magi, thinking I might keep my eye out for this. I did not catch that literary reference, Ange, but I would imagine that that was intended. 2, glad you read the Bendis Legion. I reviewed all the issues on my site. It walks that Legion tightrope. Classic enough for continuity rabid fans, different enough to bring in new readers. You should check out the Future State Legion book as sort of a sequel. Well, I did read the Millennium issues as a prequel, if that counts. Glad you read Argus and enjoyed it. I think that lifts me to a batting average of 667 in the Professor Allen liked it stat. I don't know why Sterling Gates hasn't gotten more comic work. Everything he writes works for me. You should cross-pollinate and read his Captain Victory book. As for Westerns, hope you read the Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray Jonah Hex book. Great stories, great artists. Well, Doctor, I have read a few of those, and also their New 52 All-Star Western run. And don't worry, Ange, you are at 100% as far as Professor Allen appreciated it. So that's something. Darren Sutherland, almost half of the excellent Rad Adventures podcast team, also wrote in. Hi, Professor Allen. I'm trying to adjust my workday and schedule to help me fit back in some time for podcasts that I've missed during the extremely busy recent months. And I spent some time with your latest reading journal. Enjoyed hearing your thoughts on Hellboy. I used to read it regularly for many years and remembered the volumes that you mentioned. Also, fun thoughts on Lost in Space and how you missed the show during its original run in early years in syndication. ElfQuest is another series that Ruth and I used to enjoy regularly, and I liked hearing your thoughts on some of the more recent plots. I'll have to check out Clockwork Girl. I hadn't heard of it before. Have a great day, Darren. Yes, Darren, I know that many people had their podcasting schedules totally upended in the last 16 months, and I'm thinking of both listeners and podcast producers. Some people created and listened to a ton more than ever before. And I know that many in the community ended up producing and listening to a lot fewer podcasts than in the days before. And from Sir Martin of Gray, from the also excellent blog Too Dangerous for a Girl, Professor Allen, I agree that the Superboy story that introduced the League of Assassins wasn't great, but it did give us Block. Reading that first two-parter, who could have foreseen him being plucked from baddie obscurity to become a Legionnaire, and not just a member in good standing, but one of the hearts of the team. Doctor Who fans can choose more than one heart, right? I understood that reference, Mart. Mart also said he really liked the Power Company issues. As well as featuring new characters with potential, it brought back Bork from a long-past issue of Brave and the Bold. So Block and Bork. It's reformed B-list Villain Month at your number one comics reading journal. First off, why have we not put you in charge of our marketing, Martin? Second, you are not the only person who's commented on liking the Power Company. Interesting. Chris from Professor Frenzy commented on the episode, "Now that's a show." Jason from Hawaii retweeted the episode saying that it would make excellent 4th of July holiday weekend listening. Thank you, Jason, and mahalo. Podcasting's Michael Bailey had a reaction to an offhand comment I made about the Superman storyline that he's been covering on From Crisis to Crisis. I'm not saying that's the only reason I made that comment, but it did work. Professor Allen, regarding your comment about how you are enjoying the 1996 era storyline where Clark and Lois break up, I have to say that it is a gentle and properly articulated reminder that sometimes people just like to watch the world burn. Or maybe you're secretly hoping that the breakup results in Clark ending up with what you consider to be his one true love, Lori Lamaris. I say the latter is more likely the case, but I won't rule out the former in playing a role. Great episode, as always. Podcasting's Michael Bailey. Thank you, Mike, and possibly, yes. Sir Luke of the Upstate also had some thoughts. Professor, great selection of comics as always. A few of them did jump out to me while listening. The mention of Space Family Robinson caught my attention as a series I've seen covers to or mentions of, but never have I had a chance to read an actual issue. Believe it or not, Space Family Robinson predates Irwin Allen's Lost in Space TV series. Per Wikipedia, which I have to add parenthetically, not a primary source, Gold Key started the comic series in 1962, 3 years before the show. When the show debuted, Gold Key's publishers noted the similarities between the properties, but did not take legal action against Allen because the two companies were already working together in the form of the Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea comic. Instead, an agreement was reached where the comic was renamed Space Family Robinson, Lost in Space. And I second your opinion about Mickey Mouse, Super Secret Spy. I've only read one of those stories, one which I'm pretty sure you sent me, but I do recall rather enjoying it. It is strange to me how readily I accept the idea of Donald Duck being involved in high-stakes adventure, but somehow it's still novel to me for his colleague to be in the same type of story. I definitely need to seek out more of these. You mentioned reading a couple of Power Company one-shots from DC. Here it is again. There was a series of six of those one-shots, which led up to the launch of the Power Company ongoing by Busiak and Tom Grummet. For whatever reason, this series caught my attention, even though I had missed the one-shots. Power Company was never going to be a world beater for DC, but I enjoyed it. But I enjoyed it month in and month out. Playing out the idea of a superhero team for hire as a legitimate business, examining the real-world ramifications of that, and featuring a team of appealing and well-developed new characters, Power Company was a solid read. I recommend the ongoing if you happen across it. Well, during that time when I was looking at those individual issues, Luke, I did look on the DC app, and it did not appear to be there. But if it does ever pop up, I will certainly take that recommendation from you, Sir Martin, and others under advisement. Luke concludes by saying he's looking forward to what I read in July, including the inaugural Western Comics Month. Manuel Carmona from By Indie Comics Day said, if you're not listening to the Relatively Geeky Network, are you even podcasting, brah? That is an excellent point. Thank you, Manuel. And social media support for last episode came from Sir Luke Giaconetti and Gene Hendricks, both from Two True Freaks, Clinton from Coffee and Comics and Days of High Adventure, Vic and Phoenix, Chris Lydon, Karen from Between the Pages, James from Karen, Tattooed Scorpion, Laser Lass, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Valder Villainy, Sir Iowa's Joe, Herman from Into the Weird and Long Box of Darkness, Very Late Letters, Ed Moore from Teal Productions, Spy Vinyl, Advent Comics, Derek WC, Old School Ross, Dave's Comics Hero Blog, Randy Watts, Pat Sampson from the Long Box Crusade. I think he's Laurel's assistant HR intern over there. And our reigning listeners of the year, the Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. And now, moving on to books I read last month, and as we do on this show, I'm categorizing the books that I read. And first are the issues I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. For Quarterman 171, I read 6 from Sirius 3 and 4. And for 172, I read Power Man and Iron Fist 87 with super special guest Moon Knight. And to pre-record the upcoming Quarterman 175, I read Twilight Zone number 2. That is from the Now Comics run. And for an upcoming Back to the Bins episode, I read The Sandman number 1. That's the Jack Kirby version from 1972. And also a Marvel book featuring their Sandman, Peter Parker's Spider-Man 22. It was a themed episode. And comics I read for listening to podcasts, and they're getting to be a pretty good number of these because DC Infinite apps, because of the DC Infinite app, and the many DC Comics themed podcasts that are out there, such as the Legion Clubhouse, and then listen along with episodes 101 and 102. I read Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, 255 to 257, and DC Comics Presents 13. I was a reader of DC Comics Presents when this issue came out, and as a Legion fan, I was excited for the team-up. The time travel idea of having Superman, not Superboy, working with the Legion was exciting, and the story was pretty good, especially when compared to the fill-in story in Legion 255, in which an interstellar villain is defeated by Clark Kent's glasses. And to listen to a recent episode of Shag's Justice League blah 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 podcast, I read Justice League America number 40, part of an issue's long battle against Despero. And let's just say the battle is not going well for the good guys. And to listen along with Billy and Herman on their podcast, A World of Fire, episodes 13 and 14, I read All-Star Squadron 18 through 20, which gave us a pretty solid adventure against Brainwave. For listening along with Tim Price, the Podcrasher, and his new Outcasters show, that he does with Ashford and Sarah, For episodes 12 through 14, I read Batman and the Outsiders 12 and 13 and annual number 1. The main issues finish up the origin story of Katana and also dealing with a very badly injured Batman, while the annual had the team going up against the Force of July. And then on to new comics that we read right off the shelf, and we do sort of have some, although I read these via Hoopla, and that's because Boom, at least some of their titles, release on Hoopla a week or two after the physical comes out, so I'm counting these as pretty new books, including Something is Killing the Children 17. We continue with the origin story of our protagonist, Erica, the monster hunter, as she is preparing to be initiated and trained in the ways of the House of Slaughter. Very interesting. Although, seeing as nothing actually happened in this issue, it will eventually read better as part of a trade. And I'm counting this next series, too, since it is an ongoing. And I just got caught up on Berserker 1 through 4. That is B-R-Z-R-K-R. Oh, sorry, that's capital B, capital R, capital Z, capital R, capital K, capital R. Like, Berserker! Yes, this is the Keanu Reeves comic with a little help from Matt Kent and Ron Garney. And the concept is pretty strong. It's a guy who's like 18,000 years old, a crazy good legendary fighter. That's what he was designed for, or the abilities that he was blessed with. And he pretty much remembers all 18,000 of those years, or whatever the number was. In current day, the U.S. has custody of him, and a counselor may be trying to help him, or is she? I am so glad to be reading these on Hoopla, because the books are such quick reads. I admit I'd kind of feel bad about paying cover price for them for the 4 minutes of time that they take up. Although I do hear that they're selling at markups in the secondary market, so darn you speculators. But all that being said, and all that being said with a bit of snark, I suppose, these are not bad comic books. I like the mystery, the scenario, the history of this character, and I'm interested in where this is all going. And on to the general comic reading that I did in early July, I was very excited that my friend Laurel Mountainflower posted some exciting selections from the first Quarterbin sale that she had been to since before COVID. And then, ain't she sweet, a few days later, I got a care package from her made up of some of those same quarter books, such as Swords of the Swashbucklers, number 6 from the Epic Comics line. This is right at the halfway point of the 12-issue run, and it seemed like a turning point in the series, plot-wise. What's going on is that you have future space pirates, but they end up returning to Earth in our present, and the leader tracks down her mom, who was pretty surprised by what her missing kid has been doing, and the wild crew she brings with her, including an alien. And then after half an issue of downtime, some of the crew stays behind, and some blast back off. Interesting characters, interesting worlds. It's an interesting setup as well, and solid Bill Mantlow scripting. So very enjoyable. She also sent Green Hornet 8 and 28 from the Now Comics run. I really like the earlier issue, issue 8, the younger versions, these legacy versions of Hornet and Kato, getting themselves established as individuals and as a team. Kato is a lady in this version, by the way. By the time they got to issue 28, there was a bit too much going on for me to be following all of it, but it was well written and action-packed. And I've said this more than once recently, but I am finding these Now comics to be, generally speaking, pretty good reads. from the big care package I got recently from Manuel Carmona, from Truthful Comics and the nonprofit effort Comics for Christmas. I read Star Trek New Frontiers number 9 from DC Comics from 1984. Mike W. Barr tells this story very well, tying up some movie plot points from David and Carol Marcus, and some Spock just from the dead. And then we end with a dramatic cliffhanger of the Mirror Universe Enterprise making an appearance. New Titans 100, a giant-sized issue celebrating the wedding of Starfire and Dick Grayson, which was working for Tom Paneris until Stella interrupted the wedding, like interrupted by killing the chaplain before finishing the vows. I mean, I guess technically in the comic it wasn't Stella who interrupted the wedding, but my podcasting friends and colleagues were all I could think about as I read this issue. And Damage Control number 1 from 1991, this is not the Acts of Vengeance run that I read last month, but the Dwayne McDuffie and Kyle Baker version. I've appreciated some of Baker's art in the past, and his style is distinctive. But for a series that interacts so much with the Marvel Universe, I don't think I liked that look here. The inherent wackiness and humor of Damage Control just wasn't delivered in this well enough for me to really dig it. But you know, these things happen. Crystar number 7 from Marvel from 1984. This is, I think, the third of these series I've read, and overall, they're okay. The issues themselves are action-packed, dramatic, solid professional comic books, but the overall storyline, the epic sweep, I've never really gotten into that. And from World's Greatest Comics, Black Friday and other various sales, books that cost me anywhere from 10 cents to a dollar, I read a falling apart copy of Patsy and Hedy 95 from just before I was born. Okay, stories and all that, but the key part of this title was that it was an opportunity for readers to contribute hairstyles, clothes, and everything else. I counted 74 separate instances of a reader being given credit over the 23 story pages. It got to the point where I was reading the story, trying to figure out how they would get one of the characters in a let's try on some new clothes situation. But that is what this comic existed to do. I suppose that is to say to offer reader participation. And from Eternity Comics, The Big Prize 1 and 2. The concept is pretty cool for this one. In the future, a man wins the global random lottery with the prize of being able to time travel to anywhere in the past and stay there for 24 hours. And our hero picks 1930s Hollywood. And spoilers, he gets into a ton of trouble in his one day in the past. Unfortunately, Eternity canceled the book after these two issues, so the story, originally intended to be 6, does not quite wrap up like it should. But still, I have to say I'm glad I read them. And some kid books I read, mostly from Sir Rob's care package and also some from Pulp Reality or Carolina Comics or maybe even Hoopla. I read a pretty good amount here. Comic Cavalcade, number 56. Archie, 167 and 197. The Tick, number 4, which when I posted that on the blog, Billy Hogan commented that he loves reading The Tick. Betty and Veronica, 32 and 154. B&V Double Digest, 213. Jughead Jokes, 70. Yogi Bear, 34. Reggie and Me, 5. Uncle Scrooge, 268. And Nancy, unknown number. The Uncle Scrooge issue was quite good, featuring a Carl Barks story in which Scrooge and the ducks head to outer space to find a safe place for his new money vault. And that is as wacky and wild as you would expect. The issue of Comic Cavalcade was from 1953 and came to me via Carolina Comics and More for the cool price of $3 for $1. Not only was that issue missing a cover, it was missing the first 3 sheets, or the first 6 pages and last 6 pages. Fortunately, issues from the era were 52 pages or something, so I still got a lot of content for my 33 1/3 cents. It also meant that the new front page, if you will, the page that showed up when I posted the picture, was of Nutsy Squirrel, which led TARDIS Rider to comment that a Nutsy Squirrel revival was long overdue. Agreed, Rider. Agreed. I also picked up The Unknown Number of Nancy at the same time. Again, it was missing the cover and the front page. And I really tried to figure out which issue number this was, but none of the stories have titles, and there's not even a prose story that has a title. In other words, there was nothing that I could put into the Grand Comic database to try to figure out what issue number this was. And there was only 1 page of ads, and those had no dates. So again, I ran through a bunch of issues on the Grand Comics database, but I could find no clue. So as often happens, I was clueless. By the way, that Nancy issue was not bad. It was funny. Funny enough, for sure. All right, time to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about graphic novels, trade paperbacks, and long runs that I read during July.
He was a hero to some, a villain to others. And wherever he rode, people spoke his name in whispers. He had no friends, this Jonah Hex, but he did have 2 companions. One was death itself, the other, the acrid smell of gun smoke. Death and the Acrid Smell of Gunsmoke, the Jonah Hex Podcast. Available at twotruefreaks.com.
And we're back. Talk about trades, long runs, and miniseries that I read. And it's time to do some seasonal reading like we do around here a number of months per year. And I know that this was not a major holiday per se in the traditional sense, but this year, July 24th, was the National Day of the Cowboy. And my friend Sir Luke Jackanetti and a few others of us decided that that was a good excuse to turn July into hashtag Western Comics Month, inviting many to join us as we hashtag read Western comics. So, in more or less alphabetical order, here are the Western comics I read last month. And boy, was this a way to start. All-Star Western number 10, the first ever appearance of Jonah Hex. And spoilers, this is the first appearance of many for Jonah in this segment. Now, we have a special edition I think it's called a Millennium reprint of that issue. But I also had a totally falling apart coverless version that Sir Rob Lance sent a while back. So, of course, I read that version of the issue. There was even a staple in the top left-hand corner holding the first few pages to the rest of it. CGC would grade this copy as a negative 1.5. And, of course, the Jonah Hex story is terrific. This is the one that ends with Jonah punching the Welcome to Paradise sign. And this story really lays down the Hex template in terms of his attitude, his approach, the fear he instills in others, and the hidden tenderness of his character that he occasionally lets out, often for the downtrodden, for widows, for orphans. And as good as that story was, the rest of the issue wasn't bad either. It was a weird Western story featuring El Diablo that was kind of similar to the Hex story, actually. Both men were seeking out bounties that they eventually gave to ladies whose property was in danger of being taken away. And the last story, wrapping up the origin of Batlash, had a real nice combo of action and drama as well. So at least in terms of the alphabet, this was an excellent start to hashtag Western Comics Month. Billy the Kid, 127, given to me by the great Cans and Grigorujo. This one was strange in the layout of the issue. It started and ended with Billy the Kid, and between those, you got two longer stories, 7 pages each, featuring the Cheyenne Kid. So, technically, there was more content featuring the Cheyenne Kid than there was featuring Billy the Kid. But I guess they just concluded that the Cheyenne Kid as a lead character, as a title for your comic book, just wouldn't sell as much as the name Billy the Kid, even though those two stories featuring Billy were quite bland. Bounty and Navarro, Tales of the Old West, 1-3 from Caliber. These were a trio of separate, non-continuous, 40-page black and white westerns. My favorite was Navarro, about a native man seeking justice, but in pursuing that, he runs afoul of a sheriff who seeks justice by pursuing Navarro. And the argument is made that both men are right in their own ways, and they actually respect each other in their own ways, but their paths are set on conflict. Good story, really good ending. A Bounty was also a good story about a bounty hunter, and the various conflicts he has earning a living and protecting a widow and her kid on their journey to California. The Durango Kid, 1-3, a series I found on the public domain site, the Digital Comics Museum. Like many Western comics I've found from the 1950s, this one was based on a series of films. The best story was the one where someone was impersonating the Durango Kid with black outfit and black mask, but instead of doing good, this guy was robbing stagecoaches. Which I liked because it touched on that Western trope, which is also a comic book trope, that if you dress like someone else who is a famous person, people will just assume that you are that famous person. And that was a good story hook, and overall, these were pretty solid stories. The next batch were a combo of books I got for 50 cents each at Pulp Reality, and then I went into the public domain and sort of cherry-picked at random a few more. These were stories starring the singing cowboy himself, Gene Autry Comics, 16, 19, 22, 29, 54, 64, and 97. And what distinguishes these from other Western comics was that these tended to have 22 or 24-page lead stories, as opposed to the very common practice, which I've mentioned before, of a comic issue being a collection of 6 or 8, maybe 10 pages. Now, these stories were not terribly complicated, not a lot of twists and turns. The bad guy was usually who the bad guy was originally thought to be, that sort of thing. But these contained quite a range of type of stories, types of bad guys. You got cattle rustlers, claim jumpers, stagecoach robbers, corrupt law enforcement, shady bankers, etc. And all that variety was a nice touch. Another unique aspect to the comic was the lack of a sidekick, which many, if not most, Western characters have, or maybe pick up every issue. I'm not saying that Gene Autry and Jonah Hex have a ton in common, but they do have this in common. It's just them, wandering around from place to place, trying to do good. Solid, solid stories, a legitimate surprise find. And if I find any more in the 50-cent bin, let's just say I might start socking some away for next July. Gunmaster, 85, from Charlton, just a few months before I was born. Gunmaster is the heroic identity of Clay Boone, while his sidekick, Bullet the Gun Boy, is named Bob Tellub. T-E-L-L-U-B. That's right. Bullet, spelled backwards. That is pretty much all you need to know about the seriousness of the stories in this. Actually, the lead story was pretty good. An old buddy of Clay has to get some important papers from one city to another via stagecoach, and it takes all of Gunmaster and Bullet's skills to get him there safely. And here we get, as promised, a long section of books featuring the man who was a hero to some and a villain to others. The man with two constant companions, death and the acrid smell of gunsmoke. Jonah Hex, 9, 13, 23, 40, 77, 78, and 92. Two of these were sent in by Michael Lane of Comics in the Golden Age, and a few others came from various cheap bins along the way. These are from the first DC series, late 70s up into the mid-80s. Most were written by Michael Fleischer, although one of the really good ones was written by Dave Michelinie. That was issue 13, and had the misfortune of revealing on the cover the shocking identity of the criminal who was blowing up train tracks, a 10-year-old boy, which would have been a very dramatic reveal on page 15 of the story if it hadn't been, you know, on the cover. You know, and as hard a man as Hex could be, he always had a soft spot for the underprivileged, for those on the bottom of society. We have him in some of these stories coming to the aid of widows and orphans, prostitutes, although that's not what they were called, native peoples, that's not what they were called either, and in one of the strong stories, issue 23, the exploited Chinese workers building the railroads, and that's not what they were called either. And that one starts a thread that carries throughout the series, his relationship with one of the Chinese ladies. Issue 92 was the last one in the run and had the strange characteristic of ending with Hex disappearing on the last page, like into thin air. And the following month, he appeared in the future in the start of the very strange series, Hex. And then I read a digital trade featuring the work of writer John Lansdale and artist Timothy Truman. So we have Jonah Hex, Two Gun Mojo, 1 through 5, like I said, Lansdale and Truman. I met Tim Truman at a con once, by the way. Very nice fellow. So they did this series of minis for Vertigo, and in this first one, Lansdale writes about how he thought Jonah Hex had more of a weird Western feel at times than a straight Western. He talks about this in the intro to the trade, even though he admits that those elements weren't really there when he revisited the series. But that is making it a little bit of a weird Western story, was his pitch to Vertigo for this run to bring the strange, to bring the unexplained firmly into Hex's world of westerns. This story, Tugun Mojo, includes the strangest western carnival ever, including a zombified Wild Bill Hickok. Jonah gets entwined with these weirdos, and he can't really get himself extricated before lots and lots of people are shot, including townsfolk, and I mean from lots of different towns, and natives from many tribes. Jonah Hex, Riders of the Worm and Such, 1 through 5. This one had the most clear and obvious supernatural or strange aspects, as in underground giant worms in caves. Yes, Paul Hicks, you can consider this part of the Tremors multiverse, including a few of those worms that mated with human lady folk. So yeah, that was strange. Good story. But the best part was a scrawl on one of the cave walls. Cave Carson and Rip Hunter were here. The story was good, but that moment was great. And that trade also included Jonah Hex Shadows West, 1 through 3. Again, these are all Vertigo series, so they are all weird. This one, I think, leaned mostly into the Vertigo aspect, especially in the aspect of having some boobs and bad words in it. But the strange part was the talking bear, the talking baby bear that the human lady had recently given birth to. So yeah, that was the strange part. Overall, I think Lansdale and Truman turned out to be quite a good team for this type of take on this type of character. Very enjoyable, albeit very strange reads. And from a related character, literally related to Jonah Hex, from Wonder Comics, the Ginny Hex special. This one wasn't really a Western, except that it included a relative of Jonah Hex. But she is one tough cookie, like her distant ancestor. And I, for what this was, I liked this well enough. Judge Colt, 2 and 3, from 1969, from Gold Key. In the Wild West, only one man is the law, Judge Colt. And actually, he's a pretty good judge and a pretty good overall lawman. He treats the Native Americans with fairness and equality, and is willing to hang bad guys when they deserve it. The series only ran 4 issues, but these 2, pretty darn good. I think I picked them up for 3 for a buck, and definitely well worth that. The Lone Ranger, The Death of Zorro, 1 through 5, from Dynamite, written by Andy Parks. First off, spoilers, Zorro. The actual Zorro, Don Diego, does die years into his retirement. Like, actually dies in these stories. No tricks, no hoaxes, no imaginary stories. The background of the series is of various Native tribes and their dealings with each other, as well as their individual dealings with the white man. And let's say that lots of people don't like lots of other people, and in this era, when people don't like each other, the bullets tended to fly. And after hearing of Zorro's death, the Lone Ranger and Tonto find themselves with a new mission. Protect the people that Zorro died protecting while dealing out just a little bit of justice along the way. An excellent story, a little bit more subtle and complicated than the average comic book. I quite enjoyed it. Pep Digital, 156, Wacky Wild West. Yes, this is an Archie book. Most of these were the kids coming up with reasons for dressing up in Western gear, like a theme day at school, or a costume party, or Halloween. But we also had some vacations out to Western-themed events and dude ranches. I love Archie because the company has produced so many stories in its 75-plus years of history, that no matter what the topic is, they can come up with 100 to 150 pages that fit that category. And this one was a fun take on hashtag Western Comics Month. Pep Digital 168, Now, this collected stories, again, from Archie, the company, MLJ, but from their Golden Age characters, Dottie and Ditto. Dottie was a kid who lived out west on a ranch in the current days of the 1940s with her friend Dottie and also their unfortunately portrayed young Native friend. Hey, it was the 40s. So these were silly Golden Age stories and, to be honest, only occasionally funny, at least here in the 2020s. But one important point, and I know Clinton Robinson was wondering about this. Yes, this is still better than Lil Jinx. The Rawhide Kid, 111 and 146 from Marvel Comics, from the mid-1970s, although they were reprints from the mid-60s. One of these came from Greg Arujo, and one came from a three-for-a-buck box at Carolina Comics. And both were pretty good. The Rawhide Kid tries to do good, but his reputation as a villain precedes him. Even when he tries to use his gunfighting skills in the cause of justice, he is often misunderstood. Solid stuff. And another one from the public domain, Straight Arrow, 1-5 from 1950. Evidently, this was a radio character, and the comic book was secondary. The premise is, as we say here in the 2020s, problematic. Whenever young rancher Steve Adams sees injustice, usually against members of one of the native tribes, he enters an abandoned mine to don Comanche gear, and riding the magnificent Palomino stallion who lives in the mine, he becomes the Comanche hero Straight Arrow and sets things aright. This is he and his older buddy, Packy. The adventures are pretty good themselves, actually, but that basic underlying premise, it's never really explained how he manages to pull off this ruse, but fortunately, there is no indication of changing the color of his skin. As a matter of fact, one set of bad guys pass as fake natives by doing that, but never Steve, which is a good thing. Except that it fails to explain how this secret identity thing works. And this is different from the later DC character Scalp Hunter. There's no sense that Steve / Straight Arrow is a man without a home, not being welcome in either native or white society. The weird thing is that Steve fits into the white world, while Straight Arrow is also a respected Comanche among the natives, able to forge alliances and truces among the competing tribes. So is he a Comanche who passes as white, or vice versa? Who knows? Because it was never, ever addressed. But again, squinting past the premise, the actual stories often written by Gardner Fox were really pretty good. Two-Gun Kid, 117 and 133. Again, these are 1970s Marvel reprints of stories from about a decade before. One of these came from the generous Canadian Rob Lance, and one was a quarter bin book from World's Greatest Comics. I really liked the novel-length story in 133, which combined standard Western stuff with superhero tropes. The evil villain, Harry Kane. And if you follow my fandom of my favorite squad in the English Premier League, The Beautiful Game, then you know how much fun it was for me to see an evil villain named Harry Kane. Anyway, due to the combo of native witch doctor magic and a propitious lightning strike, he is endowed with super speed, becoming no longer Harry Kane, but you can probably figure this out, right? Hurricane. But Two-Gun figures out how to defeat him, and through the injuries, physical injuries that he delivers to Hurricane, his super speed is actually not going to be of any use to him anymore. So Two-Gun Kid, getting it done. Wagon Train number 4. Pretty sure I've never seen a minute of this TV show, and I'm pretty sure they were expecting readers to be familiar with the show. So I didn't get much from the character interactions from that stuff, but the stories themselves were good. The focus on wagons and wagon trains gave it some different scenarios and plot setups, which was nice. Weird Western Tales 36 and 48, starring Jonah Hex in one issue and Scalp Hunter and Cinnamon in the other. I'm glad I had these in the collection already, as they are both very good. I've read them both before, and I liked them enough to keep them around. The first appearance of Cinnamon was especially strong, and not just because, as Shag would say,
she is hot.
Western Outlaws 17 through 21 from Fox Features from 1949. Again, these are currently in the public domain. And thank you, public domain, and thank you, Sir Luke Giaconetti, for always reminding me that tons of genre comics are available on the public domain. These ones were interesting as they focused on bad guys, making them more or less Western crime stories. And at least one of these issues on the cover used that language, referring to these as Western crime stories. And spoilers, even in the Old West, crime does not pay. And last but not least, Western Gunfighters 18, a reprint of 1950s-era Kid Colt and Apache Kid. There were other stories in here as well, but I've come to the conclusion that Western characters are kind of like the Legion of Superheroes, which is to say that if your character doesn't include the word kid in the name, how can I take you seriously in the Wild West? Actually, after reading this one with Kid Colt and previous issue that I mentioned of Judge Colt, I so want the Roy Thomas issue that explains the family connection between those two characters. No, seriously. If you took away the characters named Kid and the ones from American history, what would you have left in the Western genre? I mean, okay, you'd have Jonah Hex, but other than that, what would you have left? I know, that's a question we can't answer here, but that's a good question to leave you all with. Here, that hashtag Western Comics Month has come to an end. Thank you, Luke, for organizing this, and congratulations on its social media success. Lots of folks got involved, including, but not limited to, Sir Iowa's Joe, Kirk Spencer, Dan Schwent, Comics in the Golden Age, and Jeff's Comics. And all of them are top-notch Twitterers. So that wraps up Western Month for this year. And I guess, partners and Owl Hoots, we will see you again in about 12 months. The next themed month that I'm planning for is, of course, Halloween times in October, with plenty of horror comics. But we do have some other books to wrap up this episode with, so let's get to those. And I mentioned last time of a recent visit we took with the kind and lovely Sutherlands and the pair of European OGNs that they gave me from the Blake and Mortimer series, created by a protege and colleague of Tintin creator Hergé. The second one I read was The Atlantis Mystery, and this was a throwback to Golden Age sci-fi slash adventure stories before those two genres became distinct and separate. This is the type of story that Conan Doyle's Professor Challenger would go on. In this one, it's Professor Mortimer and his friend Blake from MI6 setting out on an undersea expedition, and this isn't a spoiler, given the title of the story, they find Atlantis. And this also isn't a spoiler, given the cover image, but the Atlanteans have spaceships, because of course they do. A thoroughly enjoyable romp of a story. Now, we did some comics organizing this month here at Relatively Geeky HQ, and Em and I gathered up all the comics from their collection, from my collection, and then the various stacks and piles from around both of our houses. We cataloged them all And then M grabbed a bunch to take back to their place. And we found some strange ones, such as this 4-issue run of a black and white series completely put together by Steve Bissett. It's the story of a dinosaur, a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and it's pretty much told from the perspective of the dinos. And yes, Tyrant 1-4 is one of the strangest comic stories I have ever read. Bissett did a ton of dino research, and based on all the cool features in the back of each issue, he had big plans for this title. This was the heyday of indie books, and clearly he had aspirations for this to be a long run, tracking the entire life of one dinosaur. Sadly, the realities of the self-publishing world cut those dreams short, and all we have are these 4 very strange, but quite beautiful comic books. Soraya was Joe, and his most recent care package included a cool section of books, including the very, very strange Eben 1-6, that's EB'NN, Eben or Eben, from Crow Quill Comics and the Now Comics. This is the entirety of the run, which is a sort of adult take on the funny animal concept. This looks like a talking animal book. I mean, it does star a big talking raven. But the situations and scenarios are definitely non-kiddie. Politics, crime, religion, drama, it's all in there. In all its black and white glory. Very strange. But thank you, Joe. I mentioned last month that I started reading some Hellboy for the first time, but I didn't quite finish the first omnibus. But I did last month, meaning I read almost Colossus 1 and 2, where Hellboy ran across another monster, this one bearing a classic horror feel, the homunculus, a sort of Frankenstein scenario. Very interesting, and the comparisons between our hero and this other monster were clear and addressed well. Very solid. And that whole first omnibus was good, I imagine. I'll be getting into omnibus number 2 in a month or two. That big care package, sent in recently by Manuel Carmona from Truthful Comics and Comics for Christmas, included Conan the Barbarian 221, 237, 253, 254, and 255. Of these, 221 stands out, as it's not so much a comic book, but an illustrated epic poem. I give Larry Hama credit for taking a shot at that type of story, and for Marvel for letting him do it. The last ones in the 250s had Roy Thomas back writing, and that helps bring an energy to the book and a real knowledge, and I'd even say a love for the character of Conan. I know that at this point, the title is only a year or two away from going away, but it's not quite showing its age just yet, at least in terms of quality. One of the issues I like in the 250s had a circulation statement, and the numbers were pretty low, especially compared to the hot extreme books of the early 90s. Especially when you consider that Conan was not new in the early 90s, but he was always extreme. But his comics popularity was starting to slip at this point, which is always inevitable, but still a shame. Manuel also sent Avengers West Coast, 63 and 99, from the early 90s, 2 issues from 3 years apart, each one featuring a different legion, the Legion of Living Lightning and the Lethal Legion. I like the Lightning one more, and that issue also includes an early reappearance of the original Human Torch. In both cases, intra-member conflicts between the teams are really a narrative strength of each issue, actually. And from the combination of Manuel's care package and 75-cent boxes at World's Greatest Comics, I read Spider-Girl 349, 15, 22, 31, 36, 37, and 47. This is the Marvel 2 era from DeFalco and Aleph. I've read a handful of these over the years, and I really enjoy them. And I've decided to not worry about reading these in the right order or anything like that. If someone like Manuel sends me some of these, or if I find them for a buck or less, I pick them up. More often than not, like almost every time, I really enjoy them. One of the issues had a circulation statement, and yes, the numbers were pretty low for the era, but the sell-through was pretty good, not a lot of wasted copies. And I think I can understand why this series kept remaining just popular enough to keep going, why it was that title that would not die. And from Kirk Spencer, I read the trade Shield 1 through 6 from 2015, which Kirk picked up for a great price. This is based on the TV show, although it has the freedom to bring in folks from around the Marvel U, which the TV show couldn't do. And Mark Waid goes crazy on this in these issues, with missions featuring Sue Storm, Scarlet Witch, Doc Strange, and even the Marvel UK team that we covered some issues from a long while back, Miss Tech. These were pretty fun reads, combining the lightness of the TV show and interactions of the TV cast with the Marvel world. Fun read. It wasn't anything earth-shattering or terribly serious. Obviously nothing that's going to change the greater Marvel universe. But the trade did deliver solid episodic TV-style stories. And from Hoopla, I read more from a Slice of Life series I've been reading recently, Giant Days, 41 through 44, in which our trio of English college lasses head powerfully into their final years at uni. Except they aren't all that powerful, more scared about the impending future and trying to make sense of their very confused and confusing love lives. That trade also included an oversized special where women glow and men plunder, in which Ed flies to Australia to meet and try to impress his new girlfriend's family. And do you know how hard it was to say that title without singing it? I know that's technically the fault of Men at Work, but personally, I blame Paul Hicks. This was a really fun issue in which Ed feels like he failed miserably to impress the fam, but it turns out he did all right. And another Hoopla series I've been reading for a while now, The Woods, 29 through 36. This wraps up that series written by James Tynan IV. You're welcome, Chris. In which a school was transported, along with students and staff and faculty, across the universe to an alien land. At this point, we've learned that the planet itself is alive or sentient or whatever you want to call it. But it's the planet itself that has been poaching folks from across Earth and a few other places for centuries, for reasons that are finally disclosed in these final issues. And as the humans are heading into a final battle with each other, a few of our heroes are finally battling the planet as well. And they, some at least, think they've figured out a way to get back home, back to Earth. But if they manage to survive the war and the planet, can they survive life back on Earth? How will our world have been changed in the 3 years that they've been gone? And how have they changed? Excellent, excellent series. And this really does wrap it up quite impressively. Good action, tight storyline, very good, distinct characters, quite an enjoyable read. Last month, I started reading some recent offerings from a classic fantasy series, and I read the second trade in July, ElfQuest, The Final Quest, 7 through 12. What The Final Quest is the bringing together of all the elves in the land, and in the air, and in the forests, and under the sea, bringing them together as one mega-tribe under the last remaining High One. But can Cutter and his Wolf Riders bring them together, and more importantly, can they all avoid their most troublesome prey, humans? Especially humans of the gun-firing, piratical type. I've enjoyed revisiting the elves, and I anticipate that I'll keep on with this quest again in the coming months. And from Hoopla series, I can't remember how I discovered or stumbled upon, but I read Philosopher Rex 1 through 6 from Arcana Comics. It's a fairly standard team of supernatural investigators in a world that is more than it seems. The main wizards are called philosophers in this world, and as the story starts, their unity is fraying, and they are divided into camps of rivals. It wasn't anything I hadn't seen before, and it was an okay telling of that type of story. And an Archie read from Hoopla, Archie Comics Spectacular, Summer Days, a seasonal collection that is almost exclusively about swimming pools and or the beach. My favorite story is where the Andrews family has bought a small portable pool, mostly for Mr. Andrews. But word gets out that Archie has a new pool, and everybody in town shows up to swim, meaning nobody had room to, you know, actually swim. Except for Archie, who was by himself swimming in the large and beautiful pool at Lodge Manor. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, the wrap-up of The Woods was very good. Sword of the Swashbucklers was solid. Gene Autry and Berserker were both pleasant surprises, although in quite different ways. I enjoyed Blake and Mortimer a lot. But in terms of what I thought was my favorite, really no doubt. It's a Western, and it stars the most iconic Western character in comics. As a matter of fact, it's the issue that introduces the world to Jonah Hex. And it tells a couple of other pretty solid stories as well. All-Star Western number 10. The original copy, Falling Apart and Everything. My favorite read of July. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of the books that I read last month. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com. Or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for the episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Not quite sure what I'm going to be reading in August, but whatever that ends up being, I will be here to talk about it in early September. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.